Hello, everyone, and welcome. This is Dr. Michelle Townsend Grove, and it is good to be with you for another week. I am very fortunate to be joined by Reverend Samuel Felderman as we look at a woman's lectionary for the whole church, Year W. This is Reverend Dr. Wilda C. Gaffney's work, and as you have heard us say 100 times, maybe more, we are inspired and awed by her translations and by her work at looking and raising up both named and unnamed women from the Hebrew scriptures and the New Testament. So we are now on the last Sunday of Epiphany. We hope that you are enjoying the season. We hope that you are in good spirits and in a good place. And we are so grateful that you are with us.
Hello, everyone, and happy Groundhog's Day a few days late. Happy Imbolc to our pagan friends and listeners. Happy Candlemas to our Christian friends. This is such a complicated time of year because the holiday season, sort of the Christmas season, is over. The lights are down, and yet it is still dark and cold out. It's dark, it's cold, it's wet. Mud season has officially begun here in the Midwest. But festivals like Imbolc and Candlemas and even Groundhog's Day remind us that spring is coming, that hope is alive and well in the world. And I'm excited to be looking at these texts today that lift up that idea that hope is alive and well, even though it may not necessarily feel like it always. Our commentary text for the day comes to us from the Hebrew Bible, from the prophet Zechariah, chapter 8, verses 1 through 8. And this is Dr. Gaffney's translation. The word of the sovereign of the heaven's legions came to me, saying, "Thus says the commander of heaven's vanguard, I am jealous for Zion. With great jealousy and with great wrath, I am jealous for her. Thus says the ruler of the multitudes of heaven, I will return to Zion, and I will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. And Jerusalem shall be called the faithful city, and the mountains of the sovereign of the vanguard of heaven shall be called the holy mountain. Thus says the Holy One of heaven's armies, elder women and elder men will sit again in the streets of Jerusalem, each with a staff in hand because of their great age. And the streets of the city shall be full of girls and boys playing in the streets. Thus says the majesty of the heavens, though it seem miraculous in the eyes of the remnant of this people in these days, should it also seem miraculous to me, says the commander of the winged warriors? Thus says the sovereign of heaven's legions, it is I who will save my people from the east land and from the west land, and I will bring them to dwell within Jerusalem, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God in faithfulness and in righteousness." Thus ends the reading of the text. Well, friends, what a text that really is. We, over the course of this season of Epiphany, have heard beautiful prophetic words from our prophets. But today's reading may take the cake, especially when it comes to the names of God, the names that are used for God that were chosen by Dr. Gaffney in her translation. Isn't it so beautiful to read some of these? Just says the sovereign of heaven's legions, or the commander of the winged warriors, or the majesty from on high. These names that are chosen speak really beautifully, not only in this text, but also in the particular time that we find ourselves in the liturgical year. Here we are in the last Sunday of Epiphany, this last declaration of this season of hope and restoration and renewal. And here we are celebrating and hearing this last hymn, this final hymn given to us in praise and in prayer for the final restoration of all things, for this coming of the kingdom, for this coming of peace, for this coming of righteousness and justice. And what a beautiful text to end our season of Epiphany with. I just want to highlight, friends, I've said this before, and Michelle always laughs at me, but just a reminder, Zechariah is a minor prophet, but that doesn't mean that he's less than the major prophets. The minors are not minor because they're less than, they're minor prophets because they are shorter. There's nothing wrong with being a shorter prophet. Some prophets are short. Okay, nothing wrong with that. They are not less than, they're just shorter. But one of the things that makes Zechariah really interesting is even as a minor prophet, the book of Zechariah is actually more minor than we might initially realize. Now, the book of Zechariah is made up of 14 chapters. If you open your Bible, you will see that there are 14 chapters in this book. But the book of Zechariah is actually two distinct books stuck together into one text. Now, chapters 1 through 8, which we read today from the 8th chapter, chapters 1 through 8 is the original book of Zechariah. It is a work that comes to us from the prophet Zechariah, who was a prophet around the same time as Haggai, which we have heard from earlier, who is a contemporary of Ezra, and they are prophesying at the time of the restoration of the temple in Jerusalem under Darius I, the Persian king. So they're speaking and prophesying at this particular time in history where the people of Israel and the people of Judah have been scattered all over the earth and have been scattered by empires, by Assyria and Babylon. And now they're starting to sort of trickle back, and Jerusalem, which had been a ruin, is being restored somewhat, and the temple is being rebuilt. And while we're a long way from the former glory that Jerusalem once had, there is this beginning of a return. And our prophecy from Zechariah is speaking out towards this idea that yes, the restoration has begun, but God, who is faithful, this sovereign of the winged warriors, this Lord of heaven, is going to finish the restoration and is going to draw people in, as it so beautifully says, from the east land and the west land, and bring everyone back. They're going to bring everyone home. And this is what we find in chapters 1 through 8 of Zechariah. Now, there's a marked shift then that happens, though, in chapter 9. Chapter 9 actually always begins with a phrase similar to this, a pronouncement, the word of the Lord. And there's a marked shift. Not only that break is really noticeable, but even how it's written changes substantially. And these last chapters, chapters 9 through 14, is a prophecy that some scholars believe at least a few hundred years later, either at the very end of the Persian Empire or at the beginning of the Hellenistic period when Alexander the Great of Greece has taken over the region. So there are these two distinct voices in the book of Zechariah, both speaking about restoration, but speaking in very different times and in very different places. As I said before, Zechariah is a minor prophet because it's short. If you're looking for something to do this week, I would encourage you to sit and read the whole book. It's not more than 20 pages. If you don't think you have time for that, I would strongly suggest at least reading the second book in Zechariah. Chapters 9 through 14 are this beautiful prophetic language that just speak really gloriously and is a perfect way of ending our Epiphany season. So I invite you to do that, friends. And those are some of the things that I wanted to share. But Michelle, I'm just fascinated to hear what, as we were looking at this text, what are some of the things that have come up for you as we've sat and wrestled with this text?
Oh, and this is fun. And you know, Samuel's right. I have been laughing every time he talks about the fact that a minor prophet isn't minor because they're lesser than. That they are. And I think one of the things to point out is that the writings are shorter. We don't know if the prophet themselves was short or not. We don't have that information, do we? I mean, maybe we do, but it's because the writings themselves are shorter at that point. And so just know it's the book itself, the number of words, the number of chapters on that. And to me, it is a slightly humorous thing because I can't imagine putting together, you know, the canon and saying, well, the major ones, they're more wordy. Do you know what I mean? And yet somehow that's how it was worked out. You know, I have really been reflecting and thinking, Samuel, about this whole idea of what it meant to come home. You know, if everyone here, you know, who is listening can imagine this, here are people who, first of all, in the Southern Kingdom, they watched their Northern brothers and sisters be dispersed. They, you know, when Assyria came in around, you know, in the 8th century, they sent the people who were living there out, not all of them, but a lot of the people they sent out, and then Assyrians moved in. And during that time, there was a real struggle with what does it mean to be faithful to God and not live in the land because God is not nearby. Their whole idea was that God lived in the temple. God was at the ark. And if I left the proximity, does that mean then that God is absent? And you see within history the expansive understanding of the nature of God not being in one location, but actually being everywhere. And what does that mean for these people? And then, you know, in the 6th century, around 580-ish, you know, when the Babylonian Empire took over, and this even happened to the Southern Kingdom. It happened to Judah. It happened to Jerusalem. And those people, primarily those who were more wealthy, you know, were the ones who were moved out. And Babylonian, the people of the Babylonian Empire moved in. And there was a lot of kind of that idea of what does it mean to be the diaspora? What does it mean to live away from Jerusalem and from Israel? And you hear that language even today. You know, those who are Jewish and faithful to their tradition will speak about living in the land of Israel, living near Jerusalem, or being the diaspora, living outside of that. And what does that mean? And for these people, during the time in which Zechariah, or the writer of Zechariah, is writing these words, they are coming back home. They are coming back to Judah and to Jerusalem. When Persia took over, and they, you know, the Persian Empire had a very different understanding of religion, and they wanted people to honor and worship their own gods and have their own religious rites. It was under the Persian Empire that the temple that was destroyed by the Babylonians was rebuilt and that the people were brought back. So here they are, they're coming home, right? And in this podcast, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about what it meant to be an immigrant. Remember, we read those words from Isaiah about the welcoming of the foreigner, the welcoming of the immigrant. Now let's look at the other side. Let's look at a different perspective. You know, what does it mean to have been away from your homeland? To either be forcibly pushed out or to have to go for whatever reason. Maybe it's because there's no food, maybe because there's no water, maybe because it's unsafe, which are all reasons that many, 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 in fact, I dare say most people immigrate. They come, when they come to the United States, they're coming for safety. They're coming for, a way to support their family so that they can live. And where is that? And so I imagine this time and these people who have immigrated because they've been forced to immigrate, they have been pushed out of their home, and now they are able to come home. And the temple is being rebuilt. What must that be like to be able to come home? I mean, what does that bring up for you, Samuel, as you think about this imagery and the words in which Zechariah is using and this whole idea of home?
Well, Michelle, as you know, it's been true of all of our readings from Epiphany, and I think especially here in our last text of this Epiphany season, it is particularly true that there is this particular historical context in which these authors are speaking, but there's also this universal context that these words are meant for a specific time in a specific place, but they're also meant for all of us. That there's a sense in which these words have a universal ring to them. And as we've moved through Epiphany, as we've moved through these texts, we've looked in different times and different ways about what it means for the restoration to be completed. We've explored what it means that the restoration will finally come. And we've gotten all sorts of clues about what that's going to look like. We've been told it's a time of peace. We've been told it's a time where the monarchy will rule with justice. It's a time where there's enough to eat. It's a time where sorrows are no more, and we can go down this list. And there have been times that we've been told how to participate in that. There have been parts of our readings that have said, keep shouting. Don't let God rest until the restoration comes. We've been told, clear the rubble and make the path straight in preparation. In the text about immigration, about the Moabites coming, we heard, how does restoration come? It comes by welcoming the foreigner who needs your help, right? And in this, our final text for Epiphany, what is the restoration? The restoration is being able to come home.
Yes.
The restoration is everyone finally being welcomed home.
Nice.
And as we move out of the season of Epiphany, and as we move into the season of Lent, which is our upcoming liturgical season, I think that's a powerful thing to sit with, is what does it mean for me, the listener? What does it mean for me as an individual to being called home? And what does it mean to be a home for others?
Yes.
And as we shift out of this time of sort of this expansive vision of the restoration and into this time of reflection, I think that that is a really powerful question that I hope we can carry with us. What does it mean to be home and be home for others?
Yes.
And
And
how can we as individuals and as a people, as a community, as Unitarian Universalists, how can we truly live into being home for everyone?
Oh,
Because
that's
that's
good.
what the restoration is.
It's a powerful imagery, and I think it can evoke both a thoughtful but an emotional response for those who are reading and reflecting on this. And I really appreciate too that you're bringing this. It's not just about I, even though we should do our own work around what is home for me. It's also though us. It is a communal question. You know, what is home for us? And defining that us is important. The communal voice is integral to this conversation. How do we welcome others home, as in groups, not just individuals? And how and where is it that we find and define home? So my hope is as we finish up Epiphany and we are getting ready to go into Lent. It's a very powerful and empowering season of the Christian liturgical calendar. It is a time of deep inner reflection. My hope is that we can continue to think about this question of what is home? Where do we find home individually? What is home for us as a community? And then, in addition, we use that to ground us as we do the deep reflective work that comes with the season of Lent. And if you want to know more about that, come later. We'll be talking about that next. How's that, Samuel, for an ending?
Friends, Epiphany has been wonderful. I think Epiphany has been a powerful time. It's been this time of expansive thought and expansive hope. But if I'm being honest, I'm ready for that in-breath that is the season of Lent. I'm ready for us to transition into some reflection because we've been expanding for a while now. And I'm excited to have draw us back in for a little bit and see what our texts have waiting for us in this upcoming season.
Thank you. And I'm hoping that everybody who's been listening will stick with us through Lent. There's a common response to Lent is to skip it and go straight to Easter. My friends, you don't want to skip Lent. Sometimes it is scary to go in and to do that work. However, it is wonderful work, and we encourage you to be a part of that. Bring your courage, bring your open heart, and know that you will find some gifts in that journey. So we will see you in Lent. Take care, my friends, until we're together again.